my daughter wrote a story last week with the, and the, it was, you had to do, do you remember? Start, middle, end. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh my gosh, I've forgotten about all that. I don't know how to do a start, middle, and end. And it was to Father Christmas, so it was really, really, really well written. Because it's like, how are you, Father Christmas? I've done, and then the middle was like, I've done this, Father Christmas. And then eventually, this is what I need. And then I'll leave strawberries, I don't know, biscuits or something for you and the reindeer. I'm like, great. So when you're writing, how does it work?
Okay, so different people write differently.
Yeah.
So they're what are called plotters. And plotters are like, they plot their story. They do the start, beginning, end. They plot it out.
Oh, right, yeah. Yeah,
pretty much with quite a lot of
that would
detail.
Be like a mystery. Like a,
No. It's any book, really. Oh. And I'm not a plotter. I'm what they call a pantser. A pantser is a writer who kind of just, you know, if I'm walking out in the road and I see something, I'm like, wow, that would, actually, that would fit into my story. Or that makes sense to me. So I'm going to include it in my story. I don't know which part of the story, I don't know where in the story it will come, but that looks like a good part. So pantsers are more, we just go with the flow and write the story that way. And I'm more of a pantser than a plotter. I really don't plot my
What does it look like? You like, you wake up and you're like, right. Do you handwrite? Do you type? Do you...
Both. If something happens somewhere where I am and I have paper and a pen, I'll write it. But also sometimes you might be reading something and it creates some kind of reference in your head and you're like, oh, I better write this down. But other times you're kind of like writing on the, you know, writing, or at least you think you're writing the story, because stories change so much, even from the beginning of your writing process to the end. Sometimes the story is really very different. But you kind of, in the end, like for me, when I was writing Perfect Marriage, if I show you the drafts, I think there's maybe...
What made you
Okay, so this is the other interesting
You've
thing.
You've been asked that so many times. I don't want to ask you questions that you've been asked before, but I need to ask.
Okay.
What made you?
Okay, so for me, what was interesting is when I was going through my initiation ceremony in the village, and they use Mbusa to teach you when you come of age.
So Mbusa, maybe we just need to explain that Mbusa for people.
Actually, that thing behind you is looks like one of the Mbusas. Actually, the white, the cream thing.
Yep.
Yeah, it looks like one of the Mbusas. Actually, so Mbusas are clay figurines that are used to teach. They're like teaching aids to teach, and so each Mbusa holds a particular lesson.
Yeah.
With the coming of age, they hold particular lessons about relationship to your mother, to even the chief.
So how old were you?
I think I was 16.
Okay.
16, yeah. So I went through that, and what struck me about that experience was that it remained very vivid in my head. Yeah. As opposed to all the lectures I've had in university and, you know, whatever, for me, teaching methodology remained very vivid, you know, the lessons, the songs. And I started wondering why, or how come this was so much more vivid than the lessons that I've been taught in a classroom, for example. So I started kind of investigating that, and what I did was just literally take apart the whole ceremony.
In your mind or with somebody?
In my mind. Where did it happen? Okay, it happened in the hut, in the bush, in the river. What were the colors used? Red, black, and white.
Yes.
What were the textures? What were the, like, everything. What were the exercises that they made us do? Why did they make us do those things? And three things emerged from that questing. One was that this, the way we have been using Mbusa and teaching through Mbusa is a pedagogy. It's a methodology. It's a teaching methodology. Two, that there was a whole lot of neuroscience behind everything that was being done through that. And then three, also, I think because I'm an artist, the whole thing is based on art. And yes. So
I there's a lot of color. There's
a lot of shapes, a lot of textures, a lot of all that. So I felt like, wow, okay. So how do I communicate this? So the first attempt at communicating these things actually ended up as a lecture. I was invited to the University of Zambia to go and give a lecture to students who are studying ritual and ceremony and all that kind of
stuff. So before you go there, how much do you think? Because I think a lot of this is sacred.
Mm-hmm.
How much of it is sacred? Because you're about to go on to say you shared that, you're sharing with me now. Yes. How much of it is sacred? Does it need to be? Or I don't know. What do we do there?
That was a question I asked myself, like, okay, what do we do here? Because even as I was doing my, investigations, one of the biggest neurological payoffs of keeping this sacred and secret is exactly what I'm talking about. The neurological payoff of a secret, if you want, is that you remember. Because everything is new, novelty also has a way of triggering your brain that something that you're familiar with doesn't.
Right.
So the whole thing of keeping it a secret so that once you get in there, this is the first time you're seeing anything and everything and hearing whatever. There's a whole neurological payload that is going on as you're going through the process.
But isn't part of the...
So for me, because that has been secret and sacred for so long, it was a question for me to say, okay, how much do I put this out into the world? How much do I keep sacred? I think there were two things that... there were quite a few things that kind of convinced me to go the other way. One, I think we're losing it.
And I was about to say, so how are you meant to, if you have that information or that rich information, are you only meant to pass it to your own people? And then doesn't that dilute it? How do we do this where it's...
In the context of...
Shared.
In the context of if our culture had remained static, that process would have carried on without interruption.
Static
as in no change, as in no other external forces came in.
Right.
When the colonials and the Christians came in, they banned the ceremonies, they edited them, they tried to change them.
Actually, whilst you talk about that, not to divert you, Vamlinga, there's some Catholic and some particular priests, I'm just talking from what I remember, who embraced it. They're like, this is so important.
Yeah.
And they embraced it in their Catholic culture. Others just like, it's not part of it because it's conflicting.
Yeah.
But some took it upon and said, actually, no. And we're going to get to your book now. Mm. And they took it upon and said, actually, this is, we cannot teach Catholicism and take away what is part of the culture.
Yeah.
So I guess you're also saying that it, at some point it was disbanded, like maybe it's not right?
I think the Catholic Church has kind of come full circle.
Yeah.
Because when they arrived, they were like, no. Now, if you go into a Catholic mass, you'll hear Malaila, which is
exactly
part of this. You know what I mean? Which is the one of the genres in terms of music that is actually even sung Mumbusa, So the Catholic Church has come a full circle.
Yes, it has.
But the other reason why I think I also wanted to write this was, yes, indeed, you mentioned priests and so forth. A lot of this was also communicated and written about and documented and communicated by priests and men.
Yes.
And one white woman who's supposed to be the expert, Audrey Richards. So for me, it was like, you know what? I've been through this. At least I can tell it from my experience and my understanding as a person who is from that culture and maybe regain our own agency over that aspect of our culture, because I think so far it's been told by other people. So there was a lot of reasons why I was thinking like, okay, I just need to do this.
So you taught, you spoke about it in public sectors and in lectures. So how did you transmit that message? What were you trying to say? Just show them, tell them,
Yeah, I think for...
Give a background of Zambia or culture.
For the University of Zambia lecture, my objective there was to say, you know what? Because they are learning about ceremony and ritual and stuff like that. My objective there was to say, you know what? The way that we've been kind of writing and documenting and analyzing ceremony and ritual is very much on the surface. Like, we don't go very deep. We just say, oh, yeah, then these boys from Mukanda go to the river and then they come back. And it's just description, you know what I mean? But I was asking them to start analyzing it, analyzing ritual, not just from what they observe, but question the scientific side, question the pedagogical side, question the art side, question the musical side, like question everything so that we start unbundling our rituals and ceremonies. And getting
and documenting it somehow?
Well, the presentation that I made at the University of Zambia eventually ended up as a paper which has been published in the Journal of Southern African Teachers, so which is a big thing. So, yes, but I felt like, okay, so it's in a journal. And, you know, happily, even now, I think sometimes I see, oh, 900 people have read your paper. They're using my paper to now talk about pedagogy and stuff like that.
Do you think we're quite female focused more than the male focus? I don't know. I do you understand my question? Mm-mm. Like, I've had a couple of people saying, look, we're focusing so much on the female side. So your experience is from a female, saw it from the female side. Do you think there's a male side of that? And anyone bringing that up, or is it something we need to focus on? They say that we're not focusing very much on the male side of our experiences.
And this is what I bring in the book as well. I think it's to remind us that even the ceremony that I actually used to create that whole story called Perfect Marriage is to show that, you know, like nowadays you go to these things and they say, oh, you know, they're teaching the girl, whatever. What I show in the book is that, especially Kulange Mbusa, it was not about the girl. It was for the both of them, you know, the two people who are getting married. And in fact, when you examine the songs, song by song, there are more songs for the man than there are even for the girl.
Do you think it's still relevant?
Very much.
You wrote a book?
Very much. Very much. Because it's really just, it's a human story.
Mm.
I don't think there's any culture, and marriage is in every culture, because marriage is rooted in our reproductive capacity to continue the species. So every culture has marriage. I think every culture has asked the same questions. What makes it work? How should we be when we're in relationship with another human being? What I put in the book is not new.
No.
In the human narrative, but it's new in the way we passed it on.
How do we manage this for the younger generation? How do we do that? I'm not gonna, it'll be difficult for you and me to give your grandchild or my child read this book or understand or teaching. Thank you.
That's why I wrote the book. And the book is about two very modern young Zambians, who are grappling with the questions that you're asking. Is this relevant? Does it, you know, so the whole tension is around that actually in the book. Ultimately, I think what both discover is that, you know, the things that are being taught with Nembusa are really just timeless things.
Yeah. Timeless. I like that.
What makes a marriage work is commitment. It's trust. It's respect.
Yeah.
It's being considerate of the
and
other.
It can work in any culture.
Any culture. I mean, I always laugh because I think one of the first when my book went on Amazon, I think one of the first reviews, if you want, somebody who put out on Twitter after they'd read my book was, you know, like a very elderly lady in Scotland, and she was like, "Wow, this was really because I was hoping that anybody would be able to identify with it, because what is in there. Yes, it's from the perspective of Bemba culture, but it is a human story.
So lastly on that one, and the obviously you can only speak from your perspective, from a Bemba perspective, mm-hmm. but every culture must have, whether you're from the East or the whatever, yes. they must have that. So I'm just hoping that somebody else is thinking like you are to yes. say, Imwe, let's talk about this, let's put it together. Yeah. yeah.
Because it's, you know, we have a story to tell.
Yes.
You know, every Zambian
yes.
ethnic group has a story to tell. And a lot of it will be very, which is, I think, what my book is creating as well. It creates a very new way of like, oh, so this is how they do it, you know? Yeah. And there's some things that we created, which for us ensured that a marriage remains fresh, the commitment remains fresh,
mm.
that the marriage vows, remain fresh. So little rituals that just help the couple to keep their marriage fresh, their vows fresh, so if that works for you, if having that marriage conversation where you say, let's renew our vows every so often, because yeah. that's the way we used to do it, because for us, vows were the stitch
yeah.
that kept the marriage together. And the couple decided on the vows that they were going to make. We didn't do the one vow at the beginning and then, you know, you keep going. For us, you were encouraged to be the observers of your marriage and the participants of your marriage.
Mm.
So you're encouraged to look at your marriage regularly and say, well, where are we? What's yeah. the pulse? And if you feel there's something that needs to be done, then you create a vow around that and say, going forward, we will do
this. And I guess it's so important now, just closing up on this one, but it's so important now because there's so much distraction.
Yeah.
I mean, you forget. You forget to look at everything. Yeah. You yes. forget to look yes. at the normal things now because everyone's yeah. in a race. Absolutely. You forget to look at each other. You forget yeah. to.
Absolutely.
And it just really has to be that commitment. Like, we have to do this, even if you have to diarize it.
Yes.
On
yes.
the same phone that is distracting yeah. us.
Diarize it and say, we have to have our conversation
yeah.
today. But also, I think the other thing that I try to bring out through one of the Mbusas actually is that I think when you start understanding and you know, one of the characters actually starts understanding it at that moment in that Mbusa, is that marriage is a very moment by moment
yes.
thing. Yeah.
And more.
Yes. And you have to, every moment is the potential of making the marriage better or worse. Every moment.
Yeah.
yeah. Every word that you say.
Yes.
Every, you know, so there's even the, there's a whole Mbusa that just encourages humor in the marriage. Laugh, you know, if your partner does something wrong, laugh. Don't get upset, laugh about it, you know.
Yeah.
So there's, for me, those things are universal. They're not,
yeah.
they're not special to Bemba culture. It's just the way we tried to pass them on.
And we're just really lucky because in other cultures, really, it's not, you know, you say you're getting married and then that's it and yeah. they don't help you through it,
no.
educate you through it, mm. take you through it.
Yeah.
We're just really, really lucky.
It is.
It's a blessing, actually.
I remember, you know, you talked about Catholic priests and
yeah.
we've said how they came the full yeah. circle. I remember talking to this Catholic priest and he was saying to me, he says, you know what, sometimes when I'm doing this pre-marriage counseling in church, I just wish I could just go and get them Mbusa. And he said, you know, he understood because he had lived, you know, in Bembaland for a very long time and they actually admitted him to some of the things. So he understood and yeah. he said, you know what? Sometimes I sit there and thinking, so what's this going to, I'm just telling them, like, do this. But when, I think the beauty about the Mbusa thing is that you actually experience your marriage before you even get into it.
Yes.
You experience how hard it's going to be. You experience what a triumph it is when the two of you come through together, you know, in a challenge together. You experience how important commitment is. Commitment, just being committed to that thing. You start understanding that your marriage, the two of you are creating the will of your marriage, how that marriage will actually be, how it will withstand any other forces from outside, yeah. you know? So they make you understand that, you know, it's, you know, in the Western world, it's kind of like you get married and then you live happily ever after. We don't have that concept at all. We tell you that it's going to be hard, that marriage is hard,
yeah.
and it's work.
It is work.
Nichinchi wababili, meaning it's work that is cut out for exactly the two of you.
Yeah.
So you have to keep working at it and keep working at it. And happiness doesn't come because you get married. It comes because you work at it.
Do you think our parents did that?
Yes. I definitely think so. Because I looked at my at my parents' marriage, and especially when I was writing this book, I was like, yeah, okay, yeah. You know? Because I could see the humor in their marriage.
Yeah.
You know, they had this sense of humor where they would play tricks on each other. I mean, like, there was a humor. Yeah. And even like when, you know, mom, and just the little things, you know, dad giving mom little gifts. It didn't have to be like big gifts. Even if like he had gone into the forest and he came back, he'd come with something. But it was also the fact that I never ever saw them fight or quarrel or raise their voices. I didn't, never.
Yeah,
I
never did.
So I really think that helped.
I think there was a respect for the institution.
Yeah, yeah, there was.
And I think your book is telling us that, but like there's so many influences now, but there was a respect for the institution.
There was a respect for the institution. Yeah. And I think that is the reason why, I make it about two young Zambians who are abroad actually when they meet.
Yeah.
And so have kind of shifted a little bit
from
all this, because they're in an environment where all that, you know, you say, you know, I love you, can we get married? And the two of you just get married. But then they have to come home and face all this
drama.
Kurunani, yes. Who is like, no, but she has the final say, why? Like, you know, this is our marriage. Well, like, why does she have a say? Yeah, so it's kind of like trying to explain all those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's awesome. We can't get away from, obviously, you've been asked about this so much, about being I have to call him Vashkulu's child, because you can't get away from that. So we have to talk a little bit about that. And we've had experiences at you've talked a little bit about it when I've met you. But what was it, your number what? What was it like growing up in the home? But you didn't know. I think at the time you didn't know, right? You didn't know what you're living with. The beauty you're living with, or the how do I call it? The, I'll find another word.
I call it the frontline seat.
there you go.
Yeah, because I think I watched so many things from a
but you didn't know.
Frontline seat.
You didn't know.
As a 5-year-old, no. I was just like, okay, so what's independence? You know,
what's up?
Jalo Jess, those things were like floating around.
Meetings in the house, yeah, and like, hey, what's...
Meetings in the house, people coming, you know, jumping onto a truck, going to Tanzania, you know. Yeah, but I think you end up kind of ingesting this stuff. Ingesting it in the sense that for me, because of that, because of hearing all those things that we're talking about floating around in the house, the fight for independence, the names, the people who were actually involved were people who were real to me.
Yeah.
They were not people I read about in a book. For me, Zambia is not an abstract concept. It's real.
Yeah.
It's very, very real. How it was created, what it took to create it, who created it, those things were very, very real to me. So, as I said, I've always felt like I was in this privileged little seat somewhere in the front row watching a country being
created.
I've
heard you speak about this, but what was that vivid moment where you're like, oh my goodness, at 5 or 6 years old, whatever, when you said, oh my goodness, I realize I'm part of a making.
Independence Day, 1964.
Yes, the flag.
Yeah.
Yeah, the flag.
The flag, yeah.
And the car.
Yeah, that, I think for me, that was what registered, like, oh, because the joy, especially from my parents, was so palpable. You know, it's like, you know, that accomplishment, like, we've done it, you know, was so palpable. You know, coming from my mom, from my dad, it was like, oh, okay. You know, this is it. This is finally the thing, you know, because, you know, when we were living in Chilenje, there were things happening, and you could kind of sense like, oh, so this is why we have to lock the doors tonight, because, you know, there's a threat from, you know, the...
But why you? Why did you take up the story? I really want to understand that one.
I think all of my siblings have their own story, because I think we all kind of experienced it from a different perspective, different ages, you know.
Right.
So I'm 5, but my brother is 9, my sister is 13, the other one is 17, you know.
Yeah.
So they're kind of looking at it from...
Their own
perspectives. Yeah. And so I look at it from my October 1964, from my, you know, that 5-6 year old self thinking.
I love it.
Wow, this is what all this was about, you know?
Yeah.
And then just like the physical change, I suppose, moving from Chilenje to Woodlands was just like, okay, this is like this is more than the Jeffersons. It was moving on up, you know. It was like, wow, okay, this is where we are now, you know.
Moving to Beverly Hills.
Yeah, I know. And I remember there was this little dog, this little sausage dog called Otto, who always used to come to our house. And, you know, my mom is, my mom had a really kind heart when it came to animals. So this little Otto, sausage dog, would always come to our house, and my mom would feed it like all the time. So when we moved from Chilenje to Woodlands, one morning we woke up and Otto was outside the door.
He came.
Yes, I don't know. Up to now, we're like, how did Otto actually find us? You know what I mean? Like, when did he read the memo? But Otto actually found us.
Ah.
So we took him back to his owner in Chilenje. He came back.
Oh, no.
And this happened like 3 times. Yeah, this little sausage dog with very short legs. And so eventually the owner said, just keep Otto, you know, like, we're going to be doing this, you know. That's Otto's going to keep coming back. So, yeah, so Otto became our dog, and Otto lived with us until she was very old. She died from old age, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that was like one of the, I think Otto was another one. I'm like, okay. We moved from there.
Okay, well, many, but...
Yeah, but, you know...
Also.
Yeah, Otto.
Otto.
Yeah.
Oh, sweet. That's so sweet. Yeah. I'm going to ask you a little bit about the museum. But again, I drive back to, you know, you've created this Women's History Museum. And I keep going back to the fact that you are driving the women's force.
Mm-hmm.
I've got like a... Who's driving the men's... That's not your issue. No, I'm just like,
not at all.
Who's driving it for men, for boys?
You know what? This is the
eternal, it's not your issue?
This is the eternal debate about affirmative action. The reason why I started the museum, I think, was the Women's History Museum, was because you hear so much about whoever, Kaunda, Sipalo, Mainza, Chona, whoever. But you don't hear anything about the women
behind,
and just the women who actually played a role in our independence, but also pre-independence as well.
Yep.
And so for me, I remember the first time we were searching for, like, okay, so where are these women in our history? Couldn't find very many. But when we went onto Wikipedia as well, we realized that even on Wikipedia, out of every 4 stories, only 1 is about a woman. You know, when historical stories, only 1 is about a woman. So it's not even special to Zambia, you know. And so we thought, okay, so let's try and balance it up a little bit and let people start learning a little bit more about women and the part that they played. Because this, you know, there's so many women who played a role.
And oh, by the way, recently now we just have to... say I haven't about Cynthia Azoukas, for example, who passed away recently. So many have passed, but I just want to mention that one as well.
Yeah,
she was amazing.
Yeah,
and recognized, a quiet mover.
Yeah,
but
very very quiet mover. But you know,
so many.
You're going to probably hear more about the male artist than you'll hear about her. So our job at the museum is to make sure that we make, you know, women who've done something for this country as well known as the men.
Yeah.
Because there's so much that goes on to recognize men, but not so much the women. So I think for us, we just wanted to...
So how do you bring them up? How do you encourage them so that you have a story and we know them? And
okay, so one of the first things that we did as the Women's History Museum was we partnered with Wikipedia.
Yes.
And we trained like 34 young people to write the way Wikipedia wants you to write, because it's very, very particular. The way you do your research, your referencing, your whatever, it's very particular. And so we trained like 34 young people, and then we kind of went on radio and television and said, you know, which women do you want to know? Who do you want to learn about, you know, from our history? And we got quite a big response from the Zambian public. And so we narrowed it down to like 100 names. And then we shared those names amongst the 34 and said, start writing, start researching. You've been trained, now start researching and writing along the lines of how Wikipedia writes. The idea there was, let's put as many of our own women's histories onto Wikipedia, and that will get at least a global eye onto our women as well. And that was an interesting exercise, which had its own issues, because this kind of Eurocentric platforms, they kind of like say who would number, who's Betty Chilunga? We haven't read of her in some whatever university journal, whatever. And we were like, yeah, but she is a historical figure for us. So why shouldn't she be on Wikipedia, you know? So those are ongoing battles. But I think at the end of the day, we managed to get more stories about our women onto Wikipedia than the two.
How are you going to make sure that even the younger generation, how do you get those stories? How do you push them through?
Wikipedia is a global platform.
Of course.
I think what we have to do is publicize that. If you want to find out about, you know, go to Wikipedia. The research has been done. You can go there and find out about this person. So that was like for us one thing that we felt could help. And fortunately for us, I think every year the Swedish Embassy has kind of funded a Wikathon, which is kind of like going back together again. The group that was trained. What have you done? How many more stories have you put out? What are you writing about? You
know? Okay, yeah.
Just to keep that momentum going. We had the Leading Ladies series, which was, we started with 10 women, one from each province, and this was pre-colonial. So from about the 1500s to about the 1800s. So a woman from each province, and we put it out there. That was, I think we got a very... amazing response for that. I think so far that series has had more than a million viewers.
Is there something more we should be doing? Like, I mean, I on your part,
I think so.
Right.
I certainly think so. I mean, I think we should be. I think one of the things about how the West gets their own narratives established is publishing. So if we publish more about ourselves, our stories, our histories, I think we'll be getting out there. What we've done also...
Is that also part of the... There's the playwriting, there's the plays.
Yeah.
Telling your story, you've got so much energy.
Yeah.
Do you sleep?
Very much. Love my sleep. But what I'm saying as well is that, you know, I was talking about publishing, and one of the things that we've done as a Women's History Museum as well is to create what we call the Women's Publishing Collective, which is a collective of women that we've brought together in academia and the fringes of academia, if you want, to start publishing together or individually, but encouraging each other to write papers, Zambian women, because we want the Zambian academics and Zambian writers to start publishing. And so... we encourage collaboration, we encourage all that. And then we have professors.
Where do I find them? Who are they?
Women's Collective. Join their WhatsApp group. It's a very, very interesting group, yeah, because it's interesting because they're writing papers, doing things. And for us, it's one of those things that needs to be done. It's one of those things that you're saying, what more can be done?
So I'm going to ask, when you wake up, how do you balance? You've got a book, a story in your head. You have to go come here. How do you do that? How do you balance your life and look amazing, by the way, at, I'm not going to say the age, and keep the hair?
66, Yeah.
How do you do it?
Okay, so for me, I think what I decided to design my life.
There we go.
I decided to design my life, like really early on. I remember the first day I entered a corporate office, you know, employed by a corporate.
I know.
And I sat there and I looked around and I thought, okay, so I'm going to be here 8 hours a day.
Well, it's more like 12 these days.
Yeah, more. And 5 days or 6 days, I was like, no, this is so not me.
Leave me alone.
I can't. That would be like my life gone. You know what I mean? And I've got so many things to do. You know, my dad always said, you didn't come here to do one thing, you know? So
I love that.
Yeah. You didn't come here to do one thing. So I thought to myself, okay, I need to learn how this corporate thing works, you know, how, you know, what people say when they're saying, to ayako nchito, you know?
Oh, it's naima.
Yeah, you know, like, what are they going to do? But it wasn't for me. So I decided to design my life around what I want to do, my creativity, because for me that is, I think, the thing that is most alive in me. It's my creativity.
Obviously.
You know, if I see something.
Because you look.
Yeah. It's, I need to be creating.
Yeah.
Otherwise I'll wilt. So I basically kind of designed my life around. When I left the corporate world, and I think I worked there for like 8 years, I decided to set up my own consulting company, which meant, again, I didn't want to say, oh, I'm just going to do like this thing that places me just in like one thing.
Yeah.
So my consulting company was something that took me into the health sector, into the banking sector, into the newspaper sector, into like everywhere. And that's what I wanted.
Nice.
Because I needed to learn as much as possible what was going on in all the sectors, what are the problems, how do people deal with whatever. And that was interesting. We did a lot of communications, did a lot of comms for like the stock exchange and things like that. For me, all very exciting. You know, did television programs, radio programs.
Yeah.
did a whole series of awareness videos for the army. A lot of stuff.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. And those videos were actually adopted by other countries.
But you enjoy it.
Totally. I think for me, it's the creative.
I think process. This is it. I'm like, yeah. I was asking about the energy, the looking so young. I'm like, you enjoy what you do.
Yes. That's the key. I think that's the key. I think that's what Einstein said. Find something that you enjoy doing and get people to pay
that's
for it.
It.
Yeah. And get people to pay you for it. And then you're good.
I'm trying to speak to my children. I'm like, let's get through school.
Yeah.
Then you can go and do what you want that you enjoy. Yeah. You have to do certain.
That's the conversation I had with my dad, because my dad was like, my dad knew and really valued my creativity.
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you there.
Yeah, supported it totally. But we had to have the conversation. Like, you have to finish school, you have to do university.
So,
and go and do what you
my
want.
Story is that my dad was in prison, as you know, and I wrote and said, Dad, I want to study fine art.
Mm.
The message came back in a letter. He's like, it's fine.
Yeah.
Just not now.
Mm.
You can find something else. I'm in prison.
Yeah.
We're not studying fine art right now. We understand your creativity.
Yes.
So we had to, you know, gig that.
Thing.
Yeah. And it's like, listen, it'll come in its own form, and it has.
It has.
In its own way.
Yeah,
it's like,
it always does.
Not right now.
Yeah.
Whilst you're bringing milk and nshima in the morning.
You know, because I think they understand that, especially in our environment, it's very difficult to kind of make a living, be stable, whatever.
Yeah, but actually now, I'm like, there's, you know, people are making a living from it.
Yeah.
So I explained to somebody the other day who didn't understand the media world. I have to say media arts.
Mm.
And basically they're looking at some pricing. And the pricing ranged, it was a big difference. I said, this is a culture, this is an industry that has just landed.
Yeah.
It's just landed in the last five years.
Yeah.
So people are finding their way and it's going to get there. But it's an amazing...
Yeah. What I find unfortunate about our industry,
yeah,
which is the creative industry, is that we don't You know, like Nigeria has maybe 400 universities that you can go to for creative.
Right.
Yeah? You know what I mean?
Right.
But here, where do you go? Yeah.
Right.
There's nowhere. So for me, I wish one day we get a leader who will actually say, this is an important industry.
Yeah.
We also need to get people who, and creatives are creatives. You know, you can force them to be whatever else, but they're creatives. Yeah, so to have, you know, people who want to do medicine have somewhere to go. People who want to do teaching have somewhere to go, but we have nowhere to go. So I think for me, that's a huge, huge difference between why the creative industry in Nigeria is contributing to the GDP of Nigeria, because they do have the skilling part of it, and people can actually go and get the skills they need and they can fly. We are doing it with sellotape and...
I hear you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hear you, because actually that's what I was trying to explain, is like we're just trying to land, not even land, we're landing.
Mm-hmm.
But not properly landed, and people are delicate. And it's actually a delicate industry, because it's not a...
It's full of ego.
You know,
as well.
If you're like a doctor, you're a doctor. Yeah. But the creative industry is so... There's so much to manage, I find there, like mentally and... And not easy, because even the outside world hasn't really accepted it either, because they don't know how to manage it.
Yeah. I think in some cases, in some places, the creative industry is really taken as an industry and nurtured as such. Yeah. But when I look at the creative industry here, it's split across like maybe 12 ministries. Like how do you?
It doesn't. Right.
So how do you even harness that power of that engine?
It doesn't have its own story.
It's like one wheel is that side, the other.
It doesn't have its own story.
No, it doesn't. Mm. So we need to harness this equal opportunity employer, because even a baby can get employed in the creative industry, and a very old man can get employed in the creative industry. So we need to harness it much more. We need to set the foundations for how that creative industry actually thrives in terms of human capital, how it thrives in terms of, the financial systems as well, because that is something that also works in tandem with a creative industry. I have to be...
So what do we do?
There are things that have happened, but I think when they're happening piecemeal, you also don't get the payoff.
Yeah.
Because I know, like, for example, we were pushing for like, okay, we must also as artists be able to go to a bank and get a loan without being asked, do you have a house, do you have a whatever, you know, the immovable assets. And yes, we actually did manage to get the Movable Assets Act, where if I have a very expensive painting which is worth $20,000, I can go and borrow on that. It's an act. It's part of the law. But to get the other side of the industry to understand, like, okay, yeah, I can take that as collateral for this.
Can we take it that you're with us for a while in your... Well, you're not going anywhere anyway.
Inshallah.
So can we rely on you to just help us move some of these things over the next, couple of years?
I'd love to do that, because there is so much potential in this industry. What I admire most about the people in this industry is that without all the things that we're mentioning, without the financial systems, without the skills foundation, without the human capital development in this sector, people have made headway.
Yes.
People have done things.
Yes.
And for me, that alone should inspire any government to say, we need to harness this. You know, the people I meet and they tell me what they're doing, I'm just like, what?
Yeah.
You managed to do that? Who trained you? Like, no, I'm self-taught. Like, what? So and you managed to get the attention of...
Yeah. So what I've also seen is that as Zambians, we've become so industrious, so entrepreneurial.
Mm.
Okay, we're a little bit behind others where they have to struggle amongst like 4 million people in a small city. But actually, it's there. The drive is there. They're there. If I'm,
yeah,
you're walking on the road, you set up a, you know, a bar, and you're with, people are really industrious.
People,
I think it's the drive is really there.
The drive is there. And you know, as I'm saying, there's so many other aspects of this industry that needs to be, to become part of the drive.
Mm.
You know, it's the skill. It's the, you can be passionate, you can be talented, you can be all that.
I think we need, what you're trying to say is that I feel like it needs to be, everything needs to be formalized.
Yes.
So my guy on the street,
mm.
he doesn't pay taxes probably.
Mm.
And so there's somebody next door saying, why am I paying taxes? And he's not. So it's just about a formalization of everything that we're doing.
And, you know, we've been trying to get all these things, you know, how do you tax artists?
Right.
Yeah. We have to have that conversation because...
That's what I'm saying.
I don't earn a monthly salary.
Yeah.
I earn when and if what I do
exactly
is liked by an audience or a group of people. But how do we tax
I hear you.
You know? So... There are all those are the pieces for me, which I think we really need to work on, because ultimately it's the artist and the nation that will win.
So that's why I was also saying that, for example, I was looking at, you know, quotations from media organizations, because the industry is so young and so new, you go from literally like the differences are so huge, because they're borrowing, they're helping, it's my cousin, it's my... It's not formalized. Yes, we have awards.
Yeah.
But we need to take it to the next level.
Yeah.
I'm gonna ask you one last thing as we close. Vampondo. You know what? And everyone asks me this, so I can ask you now. I just realized everyone says, how does it feel being an Mpondo? I'm like, this is like being a normal person, right?
I don't know. I mean, like, I don't know what it feels
like. What do you feel?
I've always been Mpundu, so I don't know what anything else feels
people
like.
People want answers. What does it feel to be? So I'm going to get it from you, because I
don't know.
How does it feel?
I don't know what it feels to be not Mpundu, you know what I mean? So I have no idea. I was born Mpundu, you know, so I don't know what.
I think we need to give an explanation, because everyone says, how does it feel to be an Mpundu? Maybe for you, because you're woman to woman. I don't know. Or
you know what? I think.
Let's help them.
The difference has just always been like, there's always someone exactly the same age as you. Who you were born with, literally, you know, in the family. In families, you're literally like maybe 3, 4, 5 years apart, but you're the same age, whatever. As women in Mpundus, it was always, it's interesting because you go through the same biological changes. You go through, you know what I mean? So it's always like, oh, okay, it's happened to her, now it's going to happen to me. So like now we're 66, it's like, you know, our forgetfulness is like, oh, okay, it's normal. Okay.
Just checking in.
Did you get your keys as well?
Yeah. Me too.
Okay, I'm good. How are your knees today? Okay. So
that's
it's good. After a party, it's like, are you awake yet? No. Okay, I'm normal.
Okay.
Yeah, so I guess you have someone who's biologically the same age as you.
Yeah.
Who you can check in and say, it's normal. Because you grew up in the same environment.
What's that person's name?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. That one.
Yeah. I mean, the amount of times that my twin sister and I now, like, we're talking about something, and then maybe somebody walks past, and then we forget what we're talking about. Like, what are we talking about? It's a mess. But at least we have someone to say, oh, this is normal.
Yeah, this is good.
Actually, we're going through something.
That's so funny.
Yeah, so. I guess for me, that's the only difference.
I can't help there, because I'm like, no. It's same day, and that's about it. Love the guy, but I can't relate.
He
comes in and rescues me at really dangerous times.
Yeah.
You know, like a brother. But
a brother. I guess, you know, for me also, it's kind of, I'm curious, like, okay, so what does it feel to not have a sister but a twin brother? That must be another experience.
Yeah, I think he's protective. Basically,
I mean, when I watch my sister's twins, who are, you know, like you guys, boys.
Yeah.
He is so protective. He's so protective over his sister.
Like, it's okay.
Yeah.
Like, it's okay.
Yeah.
We don't need to kill them. It's fine. Just go and talk to them.
And that's something that I try and bring out in the book as well, in The Perfect Marriage. I try and bring out for us in the Bemba culture, the most important relationship is a brother-sister relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you can kind of like understand, because we could see how a brother, and a sister can be so, for each other.
Yeah. And yeah, anyway, we're good there. With the phones, I'm like, I'm on silent. Just don't. Where are you? Okay. Anyway, yeah. Mlenga.
I don't get that from my twin sister, at least.
Oh. Thank you. Really great conversation.
Thank you.
And
you know what? Let me just tell you this because I remember when your mom was pregnant for you.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which absolutely sent my father into glee
for us.
Circles. Yeah, when she realized she was going to have twins. And my dad was like, yes. You know, like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, they had this bantering relationship. And I remember your mom, I don't know how many, she must have been like maybe 7 or whatever months.
Yeah.
I mean, she was huge. I remember her coming out of the car and I'm like, what? This one was going to pop. And she was pregnant for you too.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Well, there we are.
Yeah.
Nice. Thanks, Mlenga. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Good morning.
It's a good day. It's a good way to start a Monday.
I think so.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.